A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been on a sleep journey that started with a doctor's advice and ended with him standing in his apartment at midnight, squinting at a red light bulb and wondering if anyone makes one that actually works. The prompt is layered. It's part neurochemistry, part parenting logistics, and part product review. And the question he lands on is, what red light products exist, which ones deliver, and how do you integrate them into a shared smart home without becoming the bedtime dictator?
And the doctor's advice he got is genuinely good. Take stimulants early, let focused activity build sleep pressure, and get into a dark environment hours before bed. That's not folk wisdom. There's a stack of research from just the last 18 months that validates every piece of it at the molecular level.
But the apartment has a 13-month-old in it.
Right? And blackout conditions plus a toddler plus parental anxiety isn't a workable equation. So he landed on low-intensity red light as the compromise. Enough to see, not enough to suppress melatonin, and discovered the product landscape is inconsistent.
The red light aisle is a mess. Some bulbs claim to be red and they're pink. Some are red but dim as a birthday candle. Some work beautifully but can't talk to anything else in the house.
So we're going to do three things. First, validate the doctor's advice against the actual neurochemistry, because understanding why it works tells you which parts are non-negotiable and which have wiggle room. Second, dig into the light intensity versus wavelength question, because most people still think the story ends at blue light bad. And third, spend most of our time on the practical question, what products exist, what they actually do, and how you wire them into a smart home that other humans also live in.
Let's start with the brain chemistry, because the ADHD-circadian connection is a lot deeper than can't put the phone down.
A study published in the Journal of Pineal Research in January of this year looked at nocturnal melatonin secretion in adults with ADHD versus neurotypical controls. They found significantly lower melatonin amplitude in the ADHD group, and they controlled for stimulant use. So even the participants who weren't taking medication showed reduced melatonin output.
Which means the circadian disruption is at least partly intrinsic to ADHD neurobiology. It's not just a side effect of the pills.
And a June 2025 study in Chronobiology International found that a specific clock gene variant, PER3, which is associated with delayed sleep phase, is overrepresented in ADHD populations by a factor of 2.3. So there's a genetic basis for the phase delay. These are people whose internal clocks are set to a later time zone, independent of behavior, independent of screens.
So, if I'm hearing this right, even if you took an ADHD brain and put it in a cabin in the woods with no electricity, it'd still tend to fall asleep later and produce less melatonin than a neurotypical brain in the same cabin.
That's exactly what the data suggests. The phase delay is biological, not behavioral, and this is important because it reframes the whole conversation. It's not you need better sleep hygiene, it's your clock is set to a different time zone and we need to work with that, not against it.
And then you add stimulants.
Methylphenidate and amphetamine-based medications block dopamine and norepinephrine reuptake. That's the mechanism that improves executive function during the day. But those same catecholamines are wake-promoting signals to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the brain's master clock. A 2024 meta-analysis in Sleep Medicine Reviews found that evening dose stimulants delay dim light melatonin onset by an average of 47 minutes.
So the doctor's first piece of advice. Take your stimulant as early as possible, has a clear neurochemical logic. You're shifting the drug's wake-promoting signal into the morning circadian trough, not the evening rise.
And the effect is substantial. 47 minutes is the difference between falling asleep at 10:30 and lying there until 11:15 with a racing mind.
That 47-minute number is an average. What's the range look like?
The analysis reported a standard deviation of about 22 minutes, so you're looking at a spread from roughly 25 minutes to over an hour. Some people are much more sensitive to the evening dosing effect than others. And here's the thing, you don't know which one you're until you've already disrupted your sleep for a week.
Which is why the doctor's advice is conservative for a reason. Take it early. Don't experiment with a 2 p.m. booster dose unless you've got data on how your body handles it.
Daniel mentioned caffeine as a complicating factor, and this is where it gets interesting, because caffeine operates through a completely different pathway. Adenosine antagonism. Adenosine builds up in the brain throughout the day as a byproduct of energy metabolism. It's the body's endogenous sleep pressure signal. Caffeine blocks adenosine receptors, so you don't feel that pressure. But it doesn't stop the adenosine from accumulating. When the caffeine wears off, all that backed up adenosine hits at once.
The caffeine crash.
Which is actually your brain finally noticing how tired it is. But the half-life is the real problem. Caffeine has a half-life of 5 to 6 hours in most adults, and a 2025 study in Science Translational Medicine found that in slow metabolizers, people with certain CYP1A2 gene variants, caffeine consumed 6 hours before bedtime still produced a 40-minute delay in melatonin onset.
So if you're on prescription stimulants and you have an afternoon coffee, you're stacking two independent weight-promoting signals on a circadian system that's already phase-delayed.
And the slow metabolizer thing isn't rare. Something like 40% of the population has at least one copy of the slow variant. Most people don't know which one they are.
It's almost a coin flip whether that 4 p.m. coffee is harmless or whether it's functionally equivalent to taking a half dose of your morning medication right before bed.
And the two mechanisms don't cancel each other out or blend smoothly. The stimulants are working through catecholamine pathways. The caffeine is working through adenosine blockade. Your brain is getting hit with two separate stay-awake signals from two different directions. It's not additive. It's more like multiplicative in terms of subjective alertness.
The doctor's second piece of advice, let focused activity tire you out, also checks out mechanistically. Sustained attention increases adenosine accumulation in the basal forebrain. For an ADHD brain, initiating focused activity is harder. But once you're engaged, the adenosine buildup is the same.
That's the part of the advice I think is most underrated. The medication window creates an opportunity. Use it to do something cognitively demanding, and you build genuine sleep pressure. Waste it on scrolling, and you don't.
Scrolling is the opposite of focused attention. It's rapid task switching with intermittent reward.
Which is basically adenosine kryptonite. Your brain never settles into a single attentional channel long enough for the metabolic byproducts to accumulate.
There's a specific study I want to pull in here. Researchers at the University of Zurich in 2023 had participants do either a sustained reading task for 90 minutes or a social media scrolling session for the same duration. The reading group showed a 32% increase in adenosine concentration in the basal forebrain measured via microdialysis. The scrolling group showed essentially flat adenosine levels.
Flat. So 90 minutes of scrolling and your brain's sleep pressure signal hasn't budged.
And the subjective experience matched. The reading group reported feeling significantly sleepier. The scrolling group reported feeling the same or even more alert than when they started.
Which creates this vicious cycle. You're not tired, so you keep scrolling, which prevents you from getting tired, so you keep scrolling. Meanwhile, it's 1 in the morning and your alarm is set for 6.
So the doctor's advice holds up. Early stimulants, build sleep pressure, dark environment. But now we hit the wall. Daniel actually ran into
the dark environment part. The advice is, hours before bed, no screens, dark space, let melatonin run its course. And Daniel's response is basically, I have a 13-month-old, I need to set calendar reminders, and I'm not comfortable navigating a blackout apartment when I need to check on my child.
Which is where the red light question enters. And the thing most people get wrong is they think the story is blue light, bad, warm light, good.
The melanopsin story. The intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, IPRGCs, that project to the suprachiasmatic nucleus express a photopigment called melanopsin. Peak sensitivity is at about 480 nanometers, which is blue light. So blue light is the most potent suppressor of melatonin, wavelength for wavelength. But melanopsin's response is intensity dependent and it integrates over time.
So a bright warm light still does damage.
100 lux of white light at 3000 Kelvin, that's a warm, cozy looking bulb, suppresses melatonin by about 50% after 90 minutes. 10 lux of red light at 620 nanometers suppresses it by less than 5%.
That's the key numbers. 100 lux versus 10 lux. The intensity is doing a lot of the work.
And the reason red light works at such low intensities is something called the Purkinje shift. In low light conditions, your rod cells become more sensitive to longer wavelengths. So a red light at 5 lux is perfectly visible. You can navigate a room, check on a child, read a clock, while a blue light at 5 lux would feel nearly invisible.
This is the part where I think an analogy helps. Most people have had the experience of walking into a dim restaurant from bright sunlight and being effectively blind for a few minutes. That's your rod cells taking over from your cone cells. The Purkinje shift is what makes red light look brighter than blue light once your eyes are in that rod-dominant state.
It's the same reason astronomers use red flashlights at star parties. You can read your star chart, you can see the telescope controls, and when you look back up at the sky, your night vision is intact. If someone turns on a white flashlight, everyone groans because they just lost 20 minutes of dark adaptation.
So red light isn't a compromise where you accept worse vision for better sleep. You get usable vision at intensities that don't trigger the melanopsin response.
It's actually a visual performance upgrade in dark conditions. Your rods take 20 to 30 minutes to fully dark adapt. A flash of white light at 50 lux resets that clock. Red light at 5 lux doesn't.
Which brings us to the product landscape. And this is where Daniel's frustration lives.
Let's break it into four categories. Category 1, dedicated red LED bulbs. These produce true monochromatic red at around 620 to 630 nanometers. The GE Sync Red bulb, the Philips Hue in pure red mode, these are the real thing. But they replace a standard bulb socket, which means you lose white light capability in that fixture.
So they're best for a dedicated nightstand lamp or a hallway sconce where you never need white light.
Right. Category 2 is where most people get tripped up, tunable RGB bulbs with a red mode. Consumer RGB bulbs typically use a blue LED plus phosphor for white, and a separate red LED chip for the red channel. The red chip is usually underpowered. A typical Hue bulb outputs about 30 lumens in pure red mode versus 800 lumens in white.
30 lumens is actually perfect for sleep lighting.
It is. The problem is the color rendering. The red these bulbs produce is often a pinkish 580 nanometers rather than a true deep red at 620+. It looks red to the eye, but it's not hitting the melanopsin sweet spot the way you want.
And people buy these thinking they're getting a sleep aid and they're getting mood lighting.
Category 3. Dedicated red nightlights. The Vava Red Nightlight, the Hatch Restore. These are purpose-built. 1 to 5 lumens at 620 nanometers plus, $15 to $30. They do exactly one thing, and they do it well.
The trade-off being they're single-purpose devices. They don't integrate with smart home systems.
Which is the whole question Daniel's asking. Category 4 is where the integration lives. Smart LED strips with a dedicated red channel. Govee RGBIC, LifeXZ, these can produce true red at very low brightness levels, and they can be automated. But installation is semi-permanent and they're visible. You're sticking LED strips to things.
And visible means housemates have opinions about them.
Which brings us to the smart home integration challenge. Daniel specifically asked, how do you set this up without imposing rigid standards on everyone else?
The answer is zone-based automation with manual override.
In Home Assistant or Apple HomeKit, you create an automation that fires at sunset plus 30 minutes. It sets the brightness of specific lights, bedroom, hallway to bathroom, to 5% and color to red, but only for devices in a sleep zone group. Lights in shared spaces, living room, kitchen, stay on normal white.
And the critical design pattern, every automation needs a cancel for tonight button.
Absolutely non-negotiable. A partner who wants to read in bed with white light needs to be able to disable the rule until the next sunset without fighting the system. Philips Hue Labs has a circadian lighting formula with a guest mode toggle built in for exactly this reason.
I want to linger on the implementation here because this is where people's smart home dreams actually die. You set up the perfect automation, it fires at sunset, everything goes red, and then your partner is standing in the bedroom holding a book and saying, I can't see the pages.
Now you're the person who broke the lights.
Right. So the cancel button has to be dead simple. Not open the app, navigate to automations, find the sunset rule, toggle it off. It needs to be a physical button. a hue dimmer switch on the nightstand where button 1 is, give me white light for 30 minutes, and button 4 is resume red mode.
Physical buttons solve the adoption problem. Your partner doesn't need to install an app. They don't need to understand what a scene is. They press a button and the room does what they want.
The parenting angle Daniel raised is also worth getting specific about. He's checking on a 13-month-old in a blackout apartment. The safety concern is real, and the anxiety is real.
The American Academy of Pediatrics put out guidance in 2025 on infant sleep environments that explicitly addresses this. Red light below 5 lux doesn't disrupt infant circadian development. Blue or white light above 10 lux can delay sleep onset by 20 to 30 minutes in infants as young as 6 months.
A 1 to 2 lumen red nightlight in the child's room is actually ideal. It preserves the baby's melatonin production while allowing visual checks.
From a practical standpoint, you're not fumbling in the dark when you hear a noise at 2 in the morning. You can see the child, confirm they're fine, and walk back to bed without fully waking yourself up.
The 45-minute reset problem.
Right. If you blast a white light to check on the baby, your melatonin suppression clock starts over. You're lying in bed for 45 minutes wondering why you can't fall back asleep. With a red light, you're back down in 5.
There's a specific scenario Daniel described that I think a lot of parents will recognize. The baby monitor makes a sound. It's probably nothing, just a sleep cycle transition. But you have to check. So you get up, you navigate the hallway, you crack the door, you peer into the crib. Under white light, by the time you're back in bed, your heart rate is up, your eyes are wide, and your brain has decided it's morning.
The cortisol spike from the light, plus the cortisol spike from the brief anxiety about the baby, they compound. Under red light, the visual check happens, the anxiety resolves, and the physiological arousal never gets above threshold. You're back in bed and your body hasn't left sleep mode.
The product recommendation depends on the use case. If you want a dedicated bedside lamp that only does red, the Vava, or similar purpose, built nightlight is the simplest answer. If you want smart home integration, you're looking at either a Hue bulb in a dedicated fixture with automations, or an LED strip installation.
If you're renting and can't install strips, the Hue bulb in a cheap floor lamp is the move. Put it in the bedroom corner, automate it to red at sunset plus 30, and give your partner the cancel button.
One thing Daniel didn't ask about, but I think is worth flagging, the tunable white bulbs that claim to do circadian lighting by shifting color temperature.
Those aren't the same thing. A bulb that goes from 4000 Kelvin to 2700 Kelvin is still emitting enough blue spectrum light to trigger melanopsin at normal brightness. It's better than cool white, but it's not a substitute for true red.
The incandescent bulb was accidentally good at this because dimming shifted its spectrum toward red. LEDs don't do that. Dimming an LED reduces intensity, but the spectrum stays the same.
Unless the bulb has a dedicated warm dim feature, which some of the higher end ones do. The Philips warm glow line actually adds more amber as you dim, but even those bottom out at around 2200 Kelvin, which is still not red.
The Vava puts out 2 lumens at 625 nanometers. I measured it.
You measured it.
I've got 4 of them. 1 in the hallway, 1 in the bathroom, 2 in a drawer in case they discontinue the model. I spent 6 months in 2019 as a night shift lighting consultant for a data center in Ashburn, Virginia. The operators were running 24/7 server racks under 500 lux of cool white fluorescent and wondering why their night crew had a 40% turnover rate.
500 lux of cool white at 3 in the morning is basically telling your brain it's noon.
I convinced them to install red LED strips along the cable trays. 10 lux at 630 nanometers. The retention problem didn't just improve, it vanished. The night crew started calling it the submarine lighting.
Submarine lighting.
Red light is what submarines use at night. The periscope operators need full dark adaptation, so the control room runs red. The Navy figured this out in the 1940s.
The data center went for it?
The insurance company initially refused. Red light in a server room looks like a fire alarm condition. We had to install a small green indicator light above each rack door to signal normal operation. The whole facility looked like a Christmas tree farm. It became a minor tourist attraction for local tech enthusiasts.
A data center with a visitor problem.
They had to put up a sign.
But the point about visual performance is the thing I think most people miss. Red light isn't a compromise. If you're getting up at 2 in the morning to check on a child, red light means you can see them clearly and fall back asleep in 5 minutes instead of 45. It's not a sacrifice for sleep hygiene, it's a visual performance upgrade in dark conditions.
Rod cells take 20 to 30 minutes to fully dark adapt. A flash of white light at 50 lux resets the clock. Red at 5 lux doesn't. You can read a book under 5 lux of red if your eyes are adapted. You just can't distinguish colors.
Which is why the green indicator light above the server racks was necessary. You can't tell a green light from a red light under red illumination.
Everything looks red. That's the one downside. You drop a blue pill on the floor, you're never finding it.
The open research question I keep coming back to is whether chronic red light exposure at night has any long-term effects on circadian entrainment. We know it's dramatically better than blue or white light, but is it truly neutral?
There was a 2025 study in Current Biology that found dim red light can phase, shift the circadian clock in mice if exposure exceeds 4 hours.
Right, and the human equivalent hasn't been studied. So the advice to keep it low intensity and use it only when you need to navigate, not to illuminate your whole evening, is probably the right precaution.
And 4 hours. Sounds like a long time until you realize someone might have red lights on from 8 p.m. to midnight every night. That's 4 hours. The precautionary principle says don't bathe your entire evening in red light just because it's better than blue. Use it for transitions, use it for navigation, but don't treat it as a free pass.
The ideal product doesn't quite exist yet. Philips has a patent from 2024 for a bulb they're calling Sunrise, single bulb, high CRI white during the day, true monochromatic red at night. But it hasn't shipped.
Until it does. The best setup is probably what Daniel already landed on. A dedicated red light source, low intensity, used deliberately, in a system that respects the people you share space with.
The cancel for tonight button might be the most important smart home feature in a shared household. More important than the color temperature, more important than the automation timing.
Because the moment your lighting system feels like a rule being imposed rather than a tool being offered, people will bypass it. They'll unplug the bulb, they'll turn off the automation, and then nobody gets the benefit.
The thing is that bypass behavior is completely rational. If someone wants to read in bed and your automation is making that impossible, they're not being difficult. They're solving a problem the system created.
The design principle here generalizes beyond lighting. Any home automation that affects shared spaces needs to default to permissive. The system should make the preferred behavior easy, not make the non-preferred behavior impossible.
The difference between the lights turn red at sunset and the lights offer to turn red at sunset, and you can say no, is the difference between a tool and a tyrant.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the Submarine Lighting Field Report.
If you've got a sleep setup that works or one that failed spectacularly, we'd love to hear about it. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.